All right, run it.
I wonder what you mean when you use the word I. Use the word I.
Take a break.
We have an aversion to ourselves and to what's happening inside us. Inside us.
I've been very interested in this problem for a long, long time.
Something settles.
Welcome back to another episode. Today we are talking to a psychiatrist, and even hearing that word when I was in my darkest hour would have triggered me beyond belief. And now I'm sitting on couches getting the chance to interview people like today's incredible guest, Dr. Tony Mastroianni, a registered medical practitioner and consultant psychiatrist. He holds a Bachelor of Medicine and Bachelor of Surgery degree from Sydney University, aka he is very, very smart. He's a fellow and of the Royal Australia and New Zealand College of Psychiatry and has served as a consultant psychiatrist to the New South Wales Justice Health Service for almost 20 years. He is the founder of the focal length method, which is what we get into detail about today, which is essentially how we look at healing someone's emotional distress or mental health disorder, but through the lens of a much more integrated way, where we discuss everything from getting the blood results done through to their social connectedness, through to talk therapy, attachment style, the whole works. And I very rarely see a psychiatrist take this altitude of treatment. Usually it's come in, you get your medication, you might do a bit of talk therapy at best, but Tony has created this method or this model where you're looking at the 360 degree human. I referred to it in our episode as like the CEO of mental health treatment. And what an incredible North Star to have for our society to look toward and see how do we make this the norm. How do we borrow from his decades and decades of wisdom and being on the front line, helping people with incredibly complex mental illness and specializing in ADHD and schizophrenia? He knows deep down that every human has gold inside them, no matter how quote unquote sick they are. And that's exactly where we start this episode. And you'll see from the moment we begin talking, just that belief system that it is his privilege and honor to be able to bring out what is already within is such a refreshing mindset to hear from a medical professional. We're going to unpack some really amazing, juicy topics, and both of us try as much as possible not to keep it too technical and to give you constantly in this episode the so what, so that you, who might not have a medical degree, can take this information and apply it to your daily life. Can't wait for you guys to listen to this. So without further ado, introducing Dr. Tony. Dr. Tony, it's not often I get the privilege of speaking to someone who has the frontline experience that you do. A lot of the exposure I get the privilege of having directly is to people who struggle with anxiety, depression, OCD, which are in and of themselves can be incredibly debilitating experiences. I think it's a true honor to also sit with people, whether it's through them or more acute diagnosis, like maybe schizophrenia or bipolar 1, in very distressing circumstances, sometimes even psychotic breaks. And I'm so excited and grateful that we'll be able to touch on some topics that rarely I think we go toward in this space. Like, self-help is usually the way this is described, and I never want to think of myself as self-help. Like, I'm not here to just keep well people well. I'm here to help sick people feel like they want to live. And so I guess my first question, which we start with all interviews with, is what's an opinion that you have or a belief that you have about mental health that may be controversial, but you still wholeheartedly believe?
I believe that mental health is an integral, is one part of a person. Because it's about their spiritual health, their physical health, their connectedness to other people, energetically, practically, the support that the world can give them and that they can give to the world. And obviously mental health, subjectively to the person, is really, really important because it gives them a clarity, can help them develop a sense of purpose and a sense of well-being so that they can be the creator or the genius that they actually were born to be. And that's ultimately what I've always been about, is to actually find the real wonderful person that's there and just take away the bits that are hindering that.
What an amazing approach. I don't think a lot of doctors can say that I look at this model as integrated as you do. Like, even using the word spiritual as a psychiatrist delights me and surprises me. Where do you think your approach of being so rounded has come from?
Well, I think firstly from life experiences, being taught to look at the big picture of everything. I've been very fortunate with people in my life that they were there to explain very difficult concepts in a simplistic way and using analogies. And I've been told by my patients and everyone that knows me that they call me the king of analogies. All I can say is I'm still the prince, because the people before me in my family were the kings, but they taught me. And to see the bigger picture and understand it in simple terms, but that doesn't render it simple or simplistic. And perhaps if I can relate one story in my life, and that was when I was a teenager, and it was the first time I'd gone to Europe, and we visited the Vatican. It was actually my first time in Italy, even though I'm of Italian background. And I was eavesdropping on a tour guide in the Vatican that was explaining a statue of Michelangelo that was called the Pietà, which is of Mary, the Madonna, holding deceased Jesus. And she was saying that allegedly Michelangelo was known for saying that when they asked him, how can you actually make such beautiful sculptures out of a block of marble, because that's all you've got to work with? And his answer apparently was, that's easy. He said, I can see the statue inside. I just chip away the bits that don't belong. And as a 15-year-old, that, and me being open to those ideas, it just blew my mind away. It was probably the main thing I remember from that holiday. And it's essentially how I approach patients and how I approach life. So, I can see the wonderful person that's there. Yes, I'm not in any which way diminishing the troubles that they have, and it's my role to help them achieve to be the beautiful person or sculpture inside.
What a beautiful analogy. No wonder you're the prince. That is, or soon to be the king. I think that's a really healthy, therapeutic lens to take into treatment, which is my default assumption and belief is that in there is something gold. We need to take away the things that are hurting you, versus the other way around. You're sick. We need to get you to fit into another box, because this box is full of shame and there's something wrong. And I think even having that lens is going to play out in the way you talk to people and connect with them. And so I guess, was it that 15-year-old moment that inspired you to want to pursue a life in the field of mental health, or was there something else?
No, not at all. I think that just blew my mind away as into how to conceptualize people in life. Again, from personal experiences, I originally was thinking in medicine I was going to be doing, firstly, I thought it was going to be oncology, treating cancer. And then when I got to spend time with kids, I thought, oh no, I'd love to do pediatrics. But then it just hurt too much seeing kids being sick. And so I decided, no, I'm not going to do that. And I guess, the biggest pivotal moment in my medicine training at university was the first week I did my psychiatric rotation. And there was a psychiatrist who was blind. And he was sitting there in the chair, and being a young student, I think I was about 21 at the time, and impressionable, he could feel what was going on in the patients. He couldn't see them. And yet, even without words, so he obviously could hear and speak, but even without words, he energetically could feel where they're at. And he was saying, "You're feeling this. What about, tell me about this." And that blew my mind away. Another pivotal moment. I said, I just want to know. I just want to do what he does. Wow. I said, if he can do that, that's what I want to be able to do. So that's actually what swung me over to psychiatry from that moment, single moment in med school.
That makes a lot of sense, tying back to what we were talking about off air just before we started. You know, I was talking, you said you really value my lived experience and the way that it can connect with people. And I said, well, you know, what about your lived experience? And you said, sometimes it's not helpful and can actually interrupt the therapeutic process. And you said something that really struck a chord with me, which is that someone should be able to feel that you understand, not just hear the details of the story as to why you do. And so I want to click on that a bit more. What does it feel like in therapy? How does a patient know that you as the treatment professional get it?
Well, firstly, it needs to feel right to them. Now, as human beings, and you don't need to be a therapist for this, we feel other people's energy. I could be at the bus stop, you could be at the bus stop, and you can feel that the person next to you is not in a good space. You've never met them before, you don't know the detail, but you know they're not in a good space because you can feel it. You can walk into another environment and you can feel that people are really happy. You don't know why necessarily, but you can feel it. And especially in Western society, that's not being taken notice of. It's all about what we can see or hear and logically put our finger on, but certainly not energetically what we're actually connecting to. When in fact, on a subliminal level, that's what we're all connecting to. And that's why people say, oh, I get a gut feeling about this person. And their gut feeling is, they may not know the detail, but their gut feeling needs to be listened to because they're picking up something energetically. So without having to give my personal details to a patient, because that actually interferes, that's me imposing things. Even if they're seeking it out, it's me imposing and putting information that doesn't belong and is actually irrelevant to their journey. But energetically, I need to be able to feel where they're at, if they're in pain, if they're fearful, if they're bored, if they're tuning out or dissociated or depersonalized in the experience that we're having relationally in the therapy.
And some part of you is constantly trying to see something in them that you can build a thread toward, even if you haven't had that experience directly. Are you trying to relate to them on the level of, I might not have had depersonalization, for example, but I do understand that the consequence of a bad experience causes anguish and suffering, and I see your suffering in me, and in that way we're connected?
The short answer is yes. But I wouldn't be necessarily talking like that. I would just actually, I'd be feeling in that moment that they're disconnected, that they're depersonalized. So I'll actually get them to feel what's underneath that.
And how do you get to so that I'm taking now a layperson's hat. Some people might be listening to this being like, God, I would have no idea if the person in front of me is feeling anxious or depersonalized. How do we build that type of skill set so that we can start to feel more with people?
Well, it's basically being able to tune into yourself. The more grounded we are and mindful we are, we're actually tuning into ourselves. And so therefore we can pick up what's happening in ourselves. And if we come across someone else and all of a sudden what's happening in us has changed, then if we're mindful of that and calm, we can actually pick up, hang on, I'm feeling a bit disconnected here. I'm actually feeling a little bit depersonalized. And you can actually feel that that's where they're at. Now, at that moment, I may not know unless I know the person's history, and I will have to ask them questions as to why and what's led to that.
Sure.
But I could feel that they're depersonalizing at this moment.
This brings me to a point that I talk about a lot in my Real Conversations workshops that I run with people, that often the biggest barrier to helping someone through emotional distress isn't necessarily their unwillingness to speak their truth. It is actually us as a support person getting in the way with our own stories and projections, or to this point, not even having the awareness of tuning in with your own body while they're talking about their feelings. Why? Because it's incredibly confronting and overwhelming to feel with someone. And I always say one of the biggest gifts you can do to help other people is to go work on yourself, whether that be through a mindfulness practice, going to therapy, working on your trauma. Because in that way, as we're inheriting or building someone else's world in our world, our dirty laundry doesn't get stuck, and we can spit back kind of the clean clothing or accurate attunement that they're looking for. How does that land with you?
That's quite, I agree with everything you just said. It's quite nicely said, actually. Because in therapy, oftentimes I will get images of things that are in my life. And it's only because my emotion that the person's been feeling actually has triggered that memory and opened up that file inside me. So I actually work them backwards. If all of a sudden my head's jumped to that, I think, it actually acts as a reference for me to come back to, this is what I'm feeling, this is where this person's at. Because sometimes subconsciously, not intentionally, but sometimes also intentionally, people don't want to address or don't want to go where there's pain. And that's a normal human thing. None of us do.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I get that as a fellow human being.
Yeah.
We all do that in one way or another. And therefore, it's when they're doing it subconsciously that it usually happens, that I will get triggered with thoughts and ideas that belong to my life, because my brain is connecting to those images and those memories where that feeling state has been.
Takes a lot of consciousness. The words escape me right now. It takes a lot of something to walk this line. And I think the line that we're pulling on here is, you want to be attuned with someone to the extent that you can almost go into their inner world with them in real time and hold it. But you don't want to be so enmeshed in that feeling that you end up losing yourself through your own stories and feelings, emotions, traumatic history, which then attaches a story of how that person should or shouldn't feel as a result of that. So it's like, I'm a big believer that life is about balance and equilibrium. I subscribe to the Buddhist philosophy in a very big way of non-dualism and a middle path. How do we walk that line of, I'm with you, I'm feeling with you, but I'm not detached or disconnected. I'm also not overly connected where I'm now completely shifting the therapeutic process onto me.
Oh, no, I don't get involved or enmeshed or try not to.
Lay people.
No, I get that. But I'll go from my experience and then we extrapolate to the person. It's really, when they're in one feeling state, it's actually transient. It's actually allow them to sit with that feeling. In fact, I use the term sitting with feelings because they may be extremely anxious. And if they sit with their body after a few minutes, it actually shifts into something else and then into something else, transient. So can you see what felt really, really palpably anxiety provoking in their body at that moment? Minutes later, it shifts to something else. And when they realize, hang on, the doctor didn't do anything. Similarly, the layperson hasn't done anything. It's just allowing them to sit with it rather than stew on it. Because some people then get stuck and ruminate in that space without allowing themselves to feel it.
Yeah.
And then it shifts into, you know, whether it's sadness underneath, or ultimately, which is the fuel for everything, a joy and love. And when they realize that, wow, I've just gone from being very, very anxious down to, yes, I actually felt sad or I felt scared or some other emotion. It's almost like coming through the atmosphere into the different layers of the Earth's atmosphere. And initially starts to get very, very hot as you're going through and very uncomfortable. But then when you drop into that, ultimately it is driven by that joy and love, they actually realize, wow, actually you've just held my hand without even realizing that you've been holding their hand, just allowing them the space to feel it.
I'm acclimatized. I'm back in. Yeah. I want to chisel in here because we've just kind of struck a little bit of gold dust here in this rock that we're navigating around. And I believe one of the best metaphors or analogies to good support processes is basically the cleaner the mirror, the better the experience. Like, because I think a good supporter is just holding a really safe, non-judgmental mirror back to the person to be able to work, to build coherence around, to build feeling around an experience that's seemingly intolerable so that they can move through it and beyond it. I often try, I say the term sit with people in it. And, you know, at my entire curriculum, Real Conversations is built on the science and art of understanding that the greatest way to be helpful to someone, pretty much more than anything else, is to connect with them. Connecting by defined as the ability to understand where someone is at. Because when people feel understood, then the gateway, the plasticity, the willingness, everything else opens to be able to shift into something new. However, it's really hard, and maybe you can help me actually describe what sitting in it or with it means in practice and what's happening in the body. So I'll have first pass. Sitting with an emotion, say for example, you're feeling anxious, means identifying, okay, right now in my body, that's being played out with accelerated heart rate. I can feel like a fireball in my stomach, like trying to describe it in your body. And then instead of running away from it, it's the ability to actually just bring your attention to it gently and allow it to exist. And people might say, well, why would you want to maybe not amplify, but at least focus on something negative? And what I believe is the greatest reason, even a scientific reason, for what sitting in it means is your nervous system is doing bicep curls every time you're feeling an emotion without running away from it. And therefore, essentially what you're doing, kind of like desensitization and habituation, which essentially means I'm building my capacity to feel bad, and that capacity is also making way for things to feel good. What are your thoughts on the sitting with it that I just described?
I agree with what you just said entirely. I just want to remind everyone and anyone that's listening that tension that we tune into is there all the time. Mm. It's not that we've created it by tuning into it. So it's like the radio. If there's talkback radio and I don't really like to listen to it because this shock jock is scaring people and spreading half-truths, I may not want to listen to it, but it's actually existing out there. So just because I'm tuning into it, it doesn't all of a sudden, I've just created that. So that tension, whether it's anxiety, fear, sadness, angst, anger, disgust, all of those emotions, neurologically, as you've said, physiologically in our bodies, that's bubbling away. And that then may manifest in someone feeling overwhelmed or angry or going to their default coping styles, overdoing things, overcompensating or avoiding. So that's part of what I'm saying in the focal length model. In my approach to psychiatry is, and the holistic care of people, is actually making them realize what's actually happening in them and integrating all aspects of the whole person and their lives to be able to then not be afraid to sit with that emotion and see how it morphs into another one, and that one just disappears. So the tension of the anxiety you were talking about just morphs. It just disappears after you've sat with it for a bit. And then it may morph into some other one. It may be feeling heaviness or feeling powerless or feeling weak. And when you tune into your body, you actually feel it. That's where these words come from. It doesn't matter what language, what culture. It's not just poetic license that in the English language we use the word heavy or brokenhearted or sickened. They're all physical terms because that's where we feel emotion in our body. It's a neural expression.
Yes. Is it too simple or reductive to say that the inverse is true, i.e. running away from, avoiding or denying our emotions is the greatest way to get or keep us sick?
Oh, absolutely. The body holds the score, and that's not something I've invented, that term.
Bessel, yeah.
Yes, but in fact, it's true. People that suffer, you know, migraines and tension and neck spasms and feeling heavy, you know, that's where their body's carrying that sense of burden or that responsibility that they're holding on physically into their body, or that they're having, you know, gynecological problems, or that they're having abdominal pains, or that they're having sexual issues, or any other manifestation, is I'm a strong believer that neuronally that part is then susceptible. That's how the body's expressing it. And then once it expresses it one way, it pays selective attention to that. And therefore, once it pays selective attention to that part of the brain, it activates that network all the time. So it becomes the to-go-to for an expression of that sort of distress.
What is your simplest definition of resilience?
Okay. The simplest definition of resilience, I'll just make it up as I go along now, would be the ability to actually use the inherent strength in every which way, physically, emotionally, spiritually, sense of purpose, being able to draw on and knowing when and how to draw on the supports around them, being able to modify the autopilot coping styles, which are usually maladaptive in most people, or in everyone, I should say. And being able to recognize our own maladaptive thinking styles and not to eradicate them, but note them that they're there and then move into another and move into another sphere despite what is happening in front of us. So I, for example, use the term emotional hygiene with my patients, which is really no different to physical hygiene. So if it's a hot, humid day, rainy day in the middle of summer, it's not that my body's animalistic or there's something wrong with my body. If I'm running around all day long, I will sweat. I may have BO. That's just a normal progression. However, I can choose at that moment, do I just stay in that? Is that how I want to be? Or do I choose to be different? So I choose to be different. So therefore, I will say, okay, preventatively, what clothes I wear that day. Will I shower? Will I put deodorant? Will I brush my teeth, etc.? But even if with my best intention, that particular day might be awful when it comes to humidity and sweat, etc. That's not my doing. That's happened. I need to accept that, but I still choose not to be in that physical state. So I will say, I need to have another shower. I need to put a fresh shirt on. I need to put extra underarm deodorant, etc. So similarly with emotional hygiene, our autopilot, it's not that there's something inherently defective about us. When life presents itself as it does with challenges, which it does to everybody, the emotional autopilot is like the physical autopilot, is to become distressed. It's to become maladaptive. It is to feel a lot of pain and distress and perhaps even cause more distress to people around us because of that distress. It's about learning how to recognize that. And similarly to, okay, I'm hot and sweaty and smelly. Okay. Yeah. That's not what I like to be. I don't like that. Let's come up with a strategy to change that.
Yes.
So we've learned since we've been kids to do it physically. But emotionally, we're not taught any of that.
Mm.
In fact, on many occasions, the way we've been taught actually exacerbates it. Because our own parents and our own, you know, whether it be teachers or people around us, similarly are afflicted by the same things we are. So it's about teaching one recognition, the patient to recognize, okay, that's where I'm at, but I actually have a choice. I can stay in there.
Yeah.
I recognize I am in that state, so I'm not just pretending it's not there. I recognize it, but I know it for what it is. And I've got a strategy to move out of that.
I think the key word there that you've picked up on very well is the response. You know, a lot of resilience is in the response, building the ability to respond and then choosing the right type of response to the inevitable shit that life is going to throw us. Another hard question to put you on the spot, no wrong answers, just super curious. What is mental health to you? Because I don't want a WHO definition, but a lot of people don't really know when they've arrived. You know, they're doing all this work and they're like, am I there? What does even there look like? So in therapy, I guess, what's the simplest way of explaining what your goal is when you're working with someone?
I'll answer that first with another question, which is not necessarily to you, Mitch, but for us to think about.
Mm.
When are we physically healthy?
Right.
Is it when we look like someone that in a GQ magazine or on a front page of Sports Girl? Is it, what is it? Isn't it, we need to define that.
Well, the first thing that comes up for me when you ask that is it just the absence of illness? And I would say probably not. But it's the presence of something. I'll tell you what my definition of mental health is. So it's the ability to respond well to the inevitable challenges of life. So I would call that my rebound rate. So how effectively can I go from negative to neutral? That's resilience. That's a whole bunch of other stuff. Nervous system flexibility. And then there's, do I have the capacity to experience positive emotions and have deep, high quality relationships and the function to be able to perform at work? So that's three pillars of going from neutral to positive. And said another way, what I don't think mental health is a perpetual state of happiness, because the opposite of depression is mania, which has been scientifically proven to be sometimes just as dangerous. So the human body is not designed to be up all the time. We are part of life, and part of being mentally healthy is taking shit emotions, either responding well to them or using them to cultivate more important positive emotions. For example, love. Love, romantic love, is tough. Sometimes you want to strangle your partner, but it's worth it because it provides a deeper, meaningful emotion where you integrate the negative. Purpose, for example. Man, making a purpose in the shit that I do, sometimes I'm just exhausted. I'm like, there's a million easier ways for me to produce money and meet some joyous needs from having nice food or going on holidays, but I'm choosing this path and I feel more mentally healthy because of it. So it can't just be the presence of happiness. It has to be, for me, the ability to respond to the shit and then to be in pursuit of more worthwhile positives like meaning, purpose, love, and perhaps a moment of joy here and there. So just interested on your take on that.
I agree. Very well said, Mitch. With all of that, as far as mental health, it's actually being content that you have linked to actually what your purpose actually is.
Purpose is huge, hey?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that you're thriving. Now, thriving does not necessarily mean, as you said, that I'm always happy.
Yes.
It means that if I'm feeling sad, that I can feel that sadness, feel how it can feel weak, only because of the mental constructs of the physical sensations we're feeling. But I can then drop into the love that's fueling that sadness.
Mm.
And that actually drives me then to thrive. And it's when we're not mindful and connected like that, that someone is suffering from mental ill health. So it's similar to physical health. It's not that a person who's physically healthy doesn't get aches and pains if he's done too much workout at the gym, or doesn't feel sick if he's had a certain food, but he's still physically healthy, or they're still physically healthy, but then they can bounce back and they know how to bring themselves back.
Yes.
So they've got that physical awareness, and similarly with emotional wellness. It's the same thing. Because emotions are feeling. I mean, they are feelings.
Yes.
But that's no different to if I'm sitting too long on a chair, the back of my legs might get a bit sore or a bit, you know, there's too much pressure there. I don't have a disease.
Yeah.
But it's an uncomfortable feeling. If I've had too many baked beans, I may have, you know, abdominal distension and feel, you know, get some cramps. I don't have a disease. And similarly with mental health. And I think the words that people have been using over time, we're using words that are normal human emotions, albeit painful ones and painful states to be in, to equate to disease. So the favorite one of mine that I like to always give example is the word depression. Really, that's the equivalent of saying sore tummy.
Right.
It's a normal human emotion.
Sure,
to
yes.
To feel depressed and to feel sad.
Mm.
But imagine if we use the word sore tummy to mean anything from too many baked beans to Crohn's disease or stomach cancer, and we just use the same word, sore tummy. Well, in fact, that's what's happening. You know, we've gone from calling serious what used to be called melancholia, where the whole body, it's an energy shutdown of the body. Depressed mood is only one symptom of that. It's the whole body shuts down. People can't move. They have no energy. Not because they can't be bothered. It's they actually don't have any energy. They actually can't think. Their processing is actually slowed down. And yes, one of the symptoms is depressed and black mood. And we've gone from that's the equivalent of stomach cancer. And then we go all the way across to someone who's demoralized because they didn't get what they'd hoped for. They put meaning onto that loss, which makes it even more painful. Mind you, a meaning which is always false.
Yes.
Something because of their schema and their belief systems about themselves.
So I need this to feel like I'm good enough. Yes. And it's that attribution that's causing the pain. It's not the actual loss itself.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I didn't get into the basketball team like I wanted. I didn't get into the firsts. I had given it a value that, because of my own inherent belief systems, if it was mine, that I'm incapable and I'm not worthy. So I have placed value that if I get into the basketball first team, I have value. So obviously when I don't get in, it's not just I can have a wonderful time in the seconds and really shine there and really enjoy basketball, which is what I really love to do. It's no. See, that proves that I don't have capacity. I'm worthless.
I'm a failure.
That's the pain. I'm a failure. That's my pain. That I'm creating the pain. It's not actually that I didn't get into the firsts. So I'm creating that distress, and I will be demoralized. I will feel in pain, and the pain feels real. So and one needs to validate that, because the person's actually feeling in pain.
Yes.
But if you start stepping back a bit and making them realize that it's their belief systems, their coping strategies, that's actually causing their pain, then it lifts. So were they in a depressed state? Yes. Do they actually have depression that needs a tablet or that needs something, you know, a quick fix, which is where our society goes? Not at all. In fact, sometimes by actually going for the quick fix, oh yes, you're depressed, you need a tablet, actually reinforces that value, I'm broken. I'm defective. There's something wrong with me.
This is going to be a big one. Nature versus nurture. There's two parts to this. Part one, do you think every, let's say, negative emotional experience from I'm not okay all the way through to mental illness, and I mean the full spectrum, from a little bit depressed all the way through to psychosis, do you think everything is always a combination of nature and nurture, so chemistry and environment, or do you think sometimes it's all the other, or one or all?
It's always both. Always and more. Both.
Yeah, okay. Say more about that and more.
Well, that's essentially why I come up with the focal length model.
Yeah, I can't wait to dive into that.
Because it's always more. Now, the reason I use even the term focal length is an analogy to photography.
Yes.
So if I'm looking, or if we're looking at a picture, the subject matter will depend on what focal length I'm looking at. So at the moment, for our viewers, I'm looking, if I took a picture of where I'm sitting at the moment with Mitch, if I took one focal length, I'll see a fit-looking young man. If that's where my focal length is, then Mitch, you're the subject of this photograph. If, however, I change the focal length and it's actually about the coffee table in front of you, then really it's about the coffee table and you just happen to be a subject that enhances. So this is someone's coffee table. The subject is actually the coffee table and what's on the coffee table. If I extend it even further back, it's actually, it might be about the bookcase, or it might be about the beautiful pot plant that's behind you. So really that's the focus. So this is someone's bookcase. And the someone might be the person that's also in the picture, but the bookcase is where the focal length is. Now, as people, it's quite normal, either because of our own understanding of ourselves, understanding of the world, our training, our own personal biases, our avoidances, we will, all of us, focus on one or two aspects of a picture. So when a person presents in pain, they will present with the focal length that they are particularly hooked into at the moment and looking at and focused on. And that's a very valid one, right? Now, can you see if they went to a therapist who, because of their own bias or because of their own training, says, oh, yes, but I can see another focal length in your picture. Now, at that moment, it's going to be quite jarring and invalidating for the patient who presents, because so that person's not listening to me.
Yes.
If you speak to the so-called therapist or counselor, whoever it might be, they may say, oh, the patient isn't ready. Right? They're not in the right space. They're whatever term they want to use. It's because they're looking at different focal lengths. So for them, for one party, this is what's important and this is the main subject and it is real. And for the other one, it's not that. Yeah. And so I guess from my own psychiatric training, when I was doing psychiatry and in the subspecialty of ADHD in adults, which I've been spending 25 years treating and lecturing about and trying to educate fellow psychiatrists who have ignored it for many years, I would hear in my training very clever professors saying, oh, no, there's no such thing as ADHD. Look at this person's attachment. They're clearly traumatized. It's this presentation that they're scattered and they can't concentrate and they're hyperactive and impulsive is because of their trauma. And I could see that. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Oh, and then I'd see here someone else who was equally intelligent and studied and well thought out saying, no, they actually have these cognitive problems. And even when they're not in a heightened state, they actually have these cognitive problems. They're structurally, cognitively limited in these processing or in these working memory or these angles of cognition. Well, that makes sense too. And then I hear someone else saying, oh, no, it's all in the gut. It's because that's where our mind comes from. You know, that's really where you know, the body, all our emotional reactions and all our chemistry and thinking is all because of the gut. And they would give very good explanations how the gut is involved. And go, oh, that makes sense too.
Mm.
And then I thought, well, hang on. How can everyone, all of these experts and lived experience by people, including myself as a human being, have so many different opinions? And I think, hang on, are we 360 degrees looking at the same thing from different angles and actually seeing different aspects? So I start to use the idea of focal length to think, hang on, if you just have a system where you stop at different focal lengths when you look at a picture to make sure, firstly, that you're getting as much of the picture as possible. That secondly, you go to areas that may not be your area of strength, and our tendency is to avoid them, our own blind spots, so to speak, and keep us constantly vigilant that whenever someone presents with an issue, such as, oh, doc, I can't start things, I procrastinate, or I'm a hoarder, or I'm this or that, that you can actually sift through each focal length to think, hang on, how much of each focal length is actually operating at the moment? Which ones are relevant? And these are the ones that we need to work on. Not just for me as a therapist to work on high and mighty, to actually make the person understand. So that empowers them, because that's my approach. This is not about just the therapist having this system. My aim is to actually make people understand these. So that empowers them.
Yes.
So when they go to a particular person, their GP, their general practitioner, for example, and the general practitioner says, oh, we're going to run these blood tests. It's not like, oh, she or he's not hearing me. It's, I get it. They have to look at the physical domain, because there could be all these other physical
part
things.
Of the image.
That's one of the focal lengths.
Mm.
So that's okay. But then I also am empowered to say, that's fine, doc, but what about these other bits? I'm still in pain. I think those other things need looking at too.
So what I'm hearing is your approach, Dr. Tony's approach to treatment, is held under the container of what's called this focal length model. And that is essentially the belief that there are multiple dimensions or ways in which we could be looking at a problem, and we need to meet people where they are at the different focal lengths. And based on your description, there are certain domains that sit at each focal length. Just before we get into the domains, maybe to help people understand this even more, how would you characterize like this focal length model and its core tenets and beliefs? And why is that different to the traditional therapy model or practice for treatment?
Firstly, I'd like to say I'm not inventing the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
All I'm doing through this focal length method is actually having a system to look at all the spokes and don't forget any of them.
So the spokes are existing.
Yes.
You're just putting it in a framework that is maybe a bit more actionable.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And understandable. So we're rendering a very complex presentation and options and different facets for this person to get them to be the optimum they can be as a person. And rather than getting overwhelmed by that, which is the normal thing to do, it's a systematized way of doing things.
Love it.
It's really no different to anything else,
yep.
Like building a house. Yep. You need to have a systematized way.
You sort it. Yeah.
You know what I mean? You need to have a surveyor come in and survey the land first, and then you need to have an architect, and then you have to do the building construction. Now, if I'm an interior designer and that's my bent and I'm involved in this, can you see I'm just going to be constantly worrying about how it's going to look and what colors are going to happen. And yet the builder's trying to say, listen, we haven't even started the foundations. We don't even know where we're putting the pillars yet.
Yeah, let's not get a color.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So, but it's not to say that that's not a valid part of the building process, because absolutely we need to, that's what the house is for. It's to create an ambience. So that designer and the color, it absolutely is critical. That would be one of the focal lengths. But can you see there's a system
Yes.
that's put in place?
So traditional therapy mainly focus on one focal length and ignores a whole bunch of others that might be playing out at the same time?
Yes. In theory, they say they don't. The term holistic care, I haven't invented.
Yes.
Right? It is something that everyone aspires to and everyone understands. In practice, though, it's not about the whole person. In theory, it might be. Even in the assessments, it may be, if you've got someone who's really assessing the person as a whole person. But in practice, that tends not to happen because of our own biases, both from the person who presents, they have their own biases and resistances, but also from the inherent biases that a therapist has. And so, having said that, it's incumbent on having some sort of system to break that down and then integrate it. So, again, another analogy is a bit like a sound engineer at a concert. You need to have an ultimate vision. What are we aiming for? Well, we want optimal sound for this stadium, for this band. Now, can you see, if I had different frequencies, I don't just pump up the bass all the time. That's going to distort the sound. I'm not going to just do the treble, you know, like an old-fashioned transistor radio. No, I have got multiple channels, and I need to tweak based on what's in front of me now. So if for this particular song where this band member is singing as opposed to the other band member, I will need to retweak certain frequencies to get my vision, which is optimal sound. So if this particular song has got more bass or more some other instrument, yeah, I need to tweak it so it's not just about the vocals, or I need to still hear the vocals. So I'm constantly adapting,
yes,
each frequency in front of me. And that's what I'm saying about the focal lengths. I visualize them almost like a soundboard.
Yeah.
So therefore, how much at this presentation is this now? Do I need to tweak anything there, yes or no? I go through it as a medical doctor, one of a physical, for example, and I go through all of them saying which ones are relevant at this moment.
Yes. Okay. I love this. Now, the juicy part that I've just been waiting all week to hear is a little synopsis or unpack of what are the levers on the soundboard? What are their names? Obviously, we'd have to come to a lecture or a seminar or a workshop to fully learn about this in detail, which, by the way, I, whenever and wherever it is, count me in. I will pay whatever it takes. But for what you're willing to share, like on the pod, just to give people a general framework, can you kind of outline the name and maybe a one sentence click on what these 10 pillars are?
Oh, absolutely. And even though I accept what you're saying about the word pillars, the reason I don't use the word pillars is because if you had 10 pillars and one was to fall off, the other 9 will still hold up. And you don't know which pillar that falls off the band, you know, that's not supporting at this moment. You don't know, a bit like Jenga, which one's actually going to make the person crush. So that's why I don't use the term pillar, even though I know what you're saying.
Yes, no, that's a great clarification.
And so that's why I prefer the sound analogy, because can you see with a soundboard, if you're getting a couple of frequencies wrong, this very, very good singer is going to sound off when he or she's got an amazing voice. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's the so-called 10 frequencies or focal lengths, because I need to focus on them. That's why I, as a therapist, like use that term, because it reminds me I need to focus on this.
Yeah, this is my system.
That's why this focal length I have to see. The first one is physical. So starting from basics like sleep, hygiene, sleep,
bloods,
diet, exercise, the usual thing, but also any physical ailment that may actually be in this person.
Yeah, sure.
So someone might come with depression, for example. And I had a person come in, referred to me for ADHD and depression, and middle-aged man. And I went through the physical first. Well, he was actually doing the physical things as much as he could. He was actually trying to sleep well. He's doing all those things well. But when I actually went through medically, I actually discovered he actually had very low testosterone.
Bingo.
And another person,
just by changing that, you'll help him a ton, right?
Absolutely. I referred him to an endocrinologist. And we fixed up his testosterone, and lo and behold, his energy, his vitality, his cognitive issues that had been labeled as ADHD and perhaps depression related by his GP, because that's what he presented with, you see. So he didn't say, oh, I've got these other issues of testosterone. The patient was presenting with his focal length, which is, I can't focus, I can't remember things, I'm distractible, and I'm feeling really flat. Right? And they, I think, and he had researched those and maybe did a Google search and found out depression does that. And if you've got concentration difficulties, the first thing that pops up on Google is ADHD. So that's he. That's the focal length he presented with. So that's what the GP just fed back to me. That was one example. Yep. Where physical. So physical is the first one.
Yep.
The second one would be what I call the mental conditions.
Okay.
Which would be your schizophrenia, OCD, autism, any label, anything perhaps in the DSM, ICD classification, the actual conditions. So many people, when they first hear of my model, they'll say, oh, you know, are you throwing away diagnoses and going into this other model? No, not at all. In fact, if anything, I'm more rigorous about diagnoses. It mm-hmm. makes me more rigorous to see what's going on. So that would be the second focal length,
yep.
to be very clear on what diagnosis is happening. The third one is cognition. Cognition is very, very important. And when I say cognition, it's about one's actual ability. What is their concentration? What is, how are they functioning with working memory? What is their processing speed? What's their social cognition, their ability to understand social concepts? Their, you know, spatial learning, visual learning, work, visual memory, or actual nuts and bolts ability cognitively. Because many practitioners will say, oh yes, because of the second focal length of mental, the mental condition, say, oh, of course Mary can't concentrate. She's got severe depression. And so that becomes swept away. Don't worry about her cognition. So you don't really stop and think, well, firstly, this is a significant issue for her now, but it's not about the here and now only. What about historically? What about even before that? Because in all of these focal lengths, it's not just about the person. It's also about the genetics.
Mm.
They've got a story. Not only their own story that they've come up with, their narrative. That narrative comes from their family's narrative. It also comes from their physical genetics.
Mm.
So it may well be that this genetically inherited difficulty with concentration and working memory, that this is genetic. The mum had it, dad had it, or grandma had it, and Uncle Mary, Uncle John had it. So they were born with that many years before they got depressed.
Mm.
So yes, now their depression has made this worse, as it does. So that would be the third one, is cognition. The next one would be emotion, what I call emotional. And I don't like the term personality, because that sometimes it's reductionistic,
mm-hmm.
and it pigeonholes people, and it actually doesn't really tell you that much except a certain pattern, which can vary from day to day, mood to mood, week to week. So what I call emotional would be their attachment style, their temperament. Again, genetics. Their life experiences have led to those attachment styles. Where are they in their emotional maturation, like the Erikson maturation scale? You know, are they still at a teenage emotional maturity level when they're 55?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are they still at a, they haven't really completed all those different things, different stages very well so far in their lives, where they don't feel they're having industry, like it's a, that's a stage of earlier childhood.
Mm.
So you need to be aware of all of those things. The next one is very, they're all important, but the next one is what I call schema, our belief systems. So these belief systems, for, again, going back to what are our family's belief systems that, that are already transmitted to us that and we're carrying, our own self-beliefs. So you know, I'm not capable, I'm not worthy, you know, I'm not important. All these self-belief systems that cloud and are self-perpetuating in our lives. They cloud everything we see. They distort everything we do and see and perceive. Again, cultural. Our cultural belief systems.
Mm-hmm.
To be aware, how does that affect this person? And it's not about me just seeing how it does. Yes, I'd like to understand that, but it's about the person understanding. Oh, I never realized that. So society or cultural ones. Also their own sense of purpose. What is their belief about what? Do they actually even stop to think what their purpose is? Or like most people, we're just acting and reacting day by day.
Does purpose fall under belief systems?
I put it there because it's part of our understanding. Mm-hmm. So I put our understanding of ourselves.
Okay, yep.
So that's why I put it there. But people can put it wherever they want.
Yeah.
As long as they don't forget it. See, this is just about a system of not forgetting and being aware. Someone could very validly say to me, Tony, perhaps that one should go in the emotional
There's
one.
Arguments for and against all the checkboards, right? You could...
And I would say, fine. I don't mind. I don't mind. You can put it wherever you like.
Just so long as the outcome is it's looked at.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's just to be aware and that the person understands it where they put it. It doesn't worry me.
Yep.
So it's like if we were meeting with all the players involved in building a house, just because a surveyor is the first thing that has to happen here. It's not that they have to sit at the first table on the first seat at the table. I don't care if you're sitting at the opposite end, as long as we don't forget the surveyor and put them in order. So back to cognition. That's the other one. Then the other one and self-belief.
Beliefs,
we're up to schema, which is self-beliefs.
Yep.
Now the other one, which I find for me really important because it helps me understand how many of those others came to be, is trauma. And trauma in every sense of the word. So originally trauma was meant to be what we used to call the big T traumas, facing a war, seeing someone killed in front of you, you yourself almost dying, obviously it's sexual assault. So, and they're very huge traumas, and we call them the big T traumas. But if we, I don't even want to put the term little T trauma because that diminishes it. But it's how do we get to those belief systems? It's experiences, day-to-day experiences that we grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them might have been very big. Some of them might have been smaller in the big scheme of things, but they still left a mark. They changed how we thought our narrative is about ourselves.
Complex
and about the
trauma.
World. Absolutely. And those traumatic events, the reason I stop at that as a distinct domain to look at, because that actually then gives me a way to help to change them.
Yep.
And be able to, through various treatments for those traumas, to look at, this is, and make the person realize, that's why I have these beliefs and these ideas. That's why I have these behaviors. So trauma, which brings us then to the next focal length or domain, which is our coping style. So whether we avoid, whether we overcompensate, is there to go to that they've learnt, is to go towards a drug or work or gambling or sex or porn or computer games, any of those things, mm-hmm. even just constantly scrolling social media is a coping style. We may view it as I'm interested, but often it's not.
Mm.
So it's I'm bored, I'm disengaged, I'm disconnected from thriving in my life and me being present for my purpose today. So therefore I'll spend 2 hours scrolling through Instagram or Facebook
mm-hmm.
or looking at YouTube. So coping styles are really, really important because one, so that the person understands that, this is my coping style. And that might, those coping styles may actually exacerbate their original mental illness. So they may have, for example, obsessive compulsive disorder, and they may have that, but their coping style might be to overcompensate, to overcheck, to overdo, to be perfectionistic in everything they do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of their coping style. So it's not necessarily that it belongs only to the OCD. And that doesn't mean they don't have OCD. But people will say, yes, that's just my OCD. So in other words, I'm disempowered.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what they hear.
The agency's
gone. I'm broken. I've got this disorder. And they may have that legitimately, but then that identifies them, that legitimizes their schema, their belief system that I'm broken, something's wrong with me. So therefore, that will be maybe reflected in their, it will be reflected in their coping style.
Mm-hmm.
So we can predict, we can actually say, hang on, you know, this is happening to you. Just be aware of your tendency to do this. And at that moment, as a therapist, if I'm not aware of that whole soundboard, I may just focus on they're really depressed. Are they suicidal? And I do need to look at that, absolutely. But I may forget that, hang on, this guy spent 5 years trying to battle an addiction and he's been so successful and he's been clean for 5 years now. At this point, what's his coping style? I need to be reminded, because at that moment I may, because of my own fears and my own biases, focus just on the fact he's saying he's feeling like self-harming. And I may help him through that, but he's still distressed and not realize that, hang on, he's just relapsed. 3 weeks later, I realize he's relapsed on a drug or a behavior that he spent years trying to beat.
Yeah.
So, or that he isolates, or whatever his coping style would be.
Mm-hmm.
So then there'd be this coping style. The next one is of social.
Relationships?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Firstly, what are their social skills? Because it's all very easy for us to say, yes, it's important. But many people, for whatever reason, either their cognitive limitation or life experience limitations, don't have good social skills.
Mm.
So it's all very well to say, oh, Johnny, you should get out there, make some friends and join a group. Can you see, you have to look at the other focal lengths. Their self-belief is, I'm defective, I'm not, you know, no one wants me, I'm not worthy. So that's already a block. But cognitively, if they don't understand social cues because they may have autism, it's overwhelming. So we can tell them anything, they just feel more defeated. So you need to look at what are their social skills, but as you just said, what are their social connections? What are their relationships? Not just, yes, I have two parents, or I have siblings, yes, I have friends, or even the glib, I do go out. Yes, but what are the real connections?
Mm.
Are you participating? Are you connected? Or are you just attending these things? Or are you just saying these things because it's too painful and you want to avoid the topic? Now, can you see, as a therapist, if I'm looking at the whole soundboard, I'm looking at all the focal lengths, and hang on, that's no way. I can feel energetically this guy would not function well socially.
Mm.
And I can feel him avoiding, because I can feel it in myself, the resistance. That's about, you know, mirroring energies and tuning into yourself. I would feel my own avoidance coming in. Oh, really? Do I have to address this? This is all too hard.
Mm.
And I could feel it in myself. I go, whoa, hang on. Why am I feeling this? Because I'm actually picking up that person's energy because they're avoiding that area. But it's really, really important in the social sphere. So that's another important, the connectedness. And that will include, now some people say spiritual, whether the spiritual belongs in there or it belongs in the belief system. As I said, it doesn't worry me where it goes, but that's really, really important. And it's their connectedness to the universe, not just people around them in the sense of a social sense, but where are they connected to life?
Mm.
You know, whether they believe in a higher power or don't, you know, whether how they're connected to the universe, what's their own connection to their own energy, what's their higher purpose? So those things, that's critical, because unless you tap into that, that's the hub of a wheel, ultimately. Mm. You know, if they have that, and most people don't. It's, you know, saying, oh, yes, I've been a doctor for 20 years, or I've been a nurse for 50 years, and that person's done wonderful work. Absolutely. What was their purpose?
Mm.
They don't know, because they may realize 30 years into working 80 hours a week that what connections have I had with my family and friends? Yes, I've helped patients, or I've built wonderful houses, or I've done whatever I've done, designed wonderful clothes, and they have, because their genius shines through despite their self-limitations. Their genius still shines through. But have they thrived? No. So so that social domain is really important. The other one is actually, the ninth one is functionality. And what I mean by that is, obviously, for 25 years treating some very severe mentally ill people in the forensic hospital in Sydney, these are people with very severe mental illnesses. And it's not just a matter of just the psychosis, or they believe certain things that are not reality-based, or they're having perceptions like hallucinations. That's part of it. But they're actually crippled in their functioning. So their brain is degenerating, so they actually have cognitive problems, difficulties with function. They actually don't know how to plan a day, or to even tune into the fact they need a shower, or that they functionally know how to wash themselves, or functionally know I need to go and do these things with the bank or Centrelink. So you want to assess, where are they functioning like? Well, you know, do they have a driver's license? You know, are they independent? What are they functioning like in other aspects of their lives, at work, for example? They may be having a job, but actually how are they functioning in that role? Because people say, oh, you know, I work this job, and tick the box. The therapist goes, oh, tick, yes, $100,000 a year job, they must be functioning really well. And realize that this person is really struggling at work. And because of the other domains, it's really impacting on their work, mm-hmm. and their ability to thrive and be the person they want to be. And the last one is the actual social supports. Where does this person live? What's their accommodation like? Housing and lack of housing and insecurity of housing is an enormous stress for anybody. You talked about being comfortable in this space that you're in here at the moment, and it's a wonderful space. But can you see, it gives you security, it gives you comfort, it gives you safety. And if someone doesn't have that accommodation, what is their accommodation? Where are they financially? Have they got the maximum benefits if they're on a pension, for example? Do they have access to all the rental assistance and other things? Even if they have a job, where are they financially? How are they managing their finances? So what are their social supports? Do they need national disability insurance help to get them access to certain things? We, again, talk about social supports. Now, that could go in the social, but I like to see, okay, what are the support networks around them? You know, are these people accessible, these friends? Are they supportive, or are they not supportive? Or in fact, are they more toxic? Do they actually make them feel even worse about themselves?
Yep.
Are there institutional things that need to be put in for supports? So they're the 10 focal lengths. And at any moment in time, and I'd like to give you a story of a patient. And I have this patient's permission, although I'm not going to say her name, obviously, to recount how this model would work.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a patient who was sent to me, again, for ADHD, because said she'd been to a therapist for many, many, many years because of a very significant trauma that happened to her when she was a young teenager. So she'd been having trauma therapy. And the trauma therapist, very good trauma therapist, said, you know what? I actually think that, quite separate to your trauma, I think you may have ADHD. So it's not only when you're dissociating or depersonalizing that you're having these cognitive issues. So she came to me. And we actually, again, took the full soundboard, the full focal lengths. Started to focus on physically what's happening. Well, we actually found out, you know, when I started asking her questions, it became apparent to her that, oh, yes, she had hormonal issues, mm-hmm. related to her menstruation. And so when we got that attended to, that was already a huge boost to her when she went to the gynecologist and went to an endocrinologist and actually found that she had polycystic ovaries.
Yep.
And they were significantly impacting on her physically. So then I looked at, yes, the mental condition. Yes, she had post-traumatic stress disorder, definitely. And she met a couple of the different criterias for different diagnoses in there. I thought, okay, noted.
Yep.
And then cognitively, yes, absolutely. She had all of these cognitive issues that did fit into ADHD. So then by looking at the cognitive sphere, it became clear that these cognitive issues were not just related to trauma. Mm-hmm. They had quite a different trajectory. And genetically, we could bring it back to a whole line of people that would have probably fit into that category. And they hadn't experienced her trauma that she, the type of trauma that she, as far as we know. And her cognitive issues predated that trauma.
Mm-hmm.
But then we started looking at her belief systems. And it was one of, I'm powerless. And okay, she's powerless, you know, I'm not competent. So that defined her, I'm powerless and I'm not competent. Thought, okay, where did this come from? So then we looked at her attachment style, and it was one, an anxious attachment with people, and that was with her parents, with her husband, with her own son that she had. Emotionally, the attachment and belief systems, so we talked about the next one, which is schema, her belief systems included family belief systems. She was comes from a family of Holocaust survivors. So the inherent narrative of persecution, threat, fear, our very existence, that was in one that she had inherited, that belief system, that was quite separate to her own sense of incapacity. So then we looked at trauma. And of course I thought, when I started to speak to her about your negative experiences in life, obviously her focal length had been on the very big trauma that had happened to her as a teenager. But started going back a bit more and focus on her experiences in life way before then, and we actually found that her belief systems, her narrative about herself, came from experiences that happened at 3, 4, 5, 6, completely unrelated to that trauma.
Yep.
That happened, as significant and as terrible as the trauma was. So we actually did trauma therapy related to those memories from the very formative years of her life. Then when we looked at her coping style, it was one of avoidance. You know, it was, I don't have competence, and I'm powerless. That because of that schema, her coping style was to avoid. Then we looked at socially where she was at, and again because of her attachment style, she didn't have that many. She had quite many acquaintances, but she was always very anxious in her attachment to these acquaintances. So I won't go into all the details, but then we went to looked at her, what she functioning like.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd been bullied at work, but because of her self schema of I'm powerless, I'm incompetent, she concluded, I'm trapped here at work. All these things that were happening to her at work. And she was very miserable at work. And then we looked at her support structures. Well, her husband was trying to be a support structure in his own way. But we actually got to look at, what are your support structures? So can you see, as we did all that, it's like the soundboard. We tweaked every which one as things were going on, by addressing all of those areas. In the end, she ended up being, because she had wonderful sense of, we got her to realize her own sense of purpose. She was an incredibly empathic, very bright woman. And she went on to become a counselor, which she was doing anyway, but she became self-employed, running her own business and thriving. Now, this is over several years. And it's wonderful to see, because it's like seeing the sculpture. it's as soon as I saw her, I think, wow, this woman is wonderful energy inside. You can feel it, but it's being held back. And yes, there are dirty bits of things all around that don't belong, and we just need to clean them up and sweep them off to reveal that the actual wonderful person that there was inside. And so that's just an example of how the model would apply. And to keep us honest on both sides, because in explaining things to her in that way, she would actually say, oh, I think this, we need to look at this, or I've actually been aware of this, that. So it's not just about me secretly holding the cards, this is my secret methodology.
Yeah.
It's actually empowering the person along the way.
To understand where we're going. Thank you for that explanation and taking us through each of the soundboard channels. And for then bringing that home with an example. It's so funny as you were talking, I look at my career and what I'm doing in mental health in three pillars. Connection, or the power of relationships. Real conversations is the main technology I use to create change there. Resilience, or what I would call emotional fortitude. How do you get sick people to become well, or at least want to survive? And then high performance, which is how do you help people thrive? Connection is kind of where I'm mostly focused and do a lot of my work in. But I've scaffolded a book that has taken me, I'm writing one this year on connection, sorry, this month, finishing it off. And then I've scaffolded my next book on resilience, and coping tools and getting people better. And I've been taking notes on that for literally 2 to 3 years. And I currently, just so that when it comes out, you don't think Mitch has stolen my IP, have 10 pillars. But I much prefer your words in soundboards. And they're very similar. There are some slight differences. And I hope that as I write that and as we grow our relationship and friendship, that I can compare notes, because it's also very validating to hear that as such an esteemed and established and credible and therapeutic professional that you are, that you do agree that you can almost create this, like, maybe not ingredient list, but at least universe that you're like, okay, if this is the headings and there's puzzle pieces that sit under each one, regardless of which one they sit under, if we tweak enough of these, something good's going to happen. And I wholeheartedly believe that before you got here, and I believe that even more now, that you get the right puzzle pieces and you do the right work, good things will happen. Now, I guess my two follow-up questions, and I don't even know how long we've been going, probably an hour and a half.
Yes.
Yeah. So we'll bring it home over the next 5 minutes, but my two follow-up questions that are hopefully simple. One is, when you're doing this map, this focal length model, and you're almost doing an inventory assessment, do you rate them out of 10 in each channel? And then when you sequence them, do you go worst to best, or how does that happen?
No, not at all. In each of those frequencies, those domains, I'm looking at strengths and weaknesses. So it's not about putting a value or a number.
Okay.
Because I find that misses the point, because it doesn't actually make me see the bits that I have to strengthen or help strengthen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that I have to do it all, because I don't pretend to be that.
Yeah.
But it's just to alert the patient. Do you think?
Sure.
Do you agree that this is an area that we need to strengthen? Let's work together on how we can do that.
Roger that.
But keeping in mind, you have all of these wonderful strengths.
Yeah. Underpinned.
In this domain.
Yep.
Because oftentimes in their mood state at that moment, they may actually not even realize that.
100%. So let's say you've got the physical and the social and the emotional, and you identify there's a bunch of strengths in there, but in these three pillars, there's something juicy, something crunchy I'd like to work. How do you know which one to action first?
It will depend on the one that's probably holding them back
yep.
the okay. most.
Yeah. So you're going in level of... what is presenting to be most disabling, and we'll work from there and into relief.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. And my
and it's not necessarily in one domain, because in addressing that one thing, that one, whatever that thing is, could actually need you to use three or four domains.
So you might be parallel pathing a few things.
Always. Yeah, that's why I use the soundboard analogy.
Right.
Because you're constantly monitoring that and doing the whole thing.
And I don't want to oversimplify this again, but the focal length model sounds almost like a frame of reference to understand a problem and then identify a potential way forward to healing that problem. But I'm assuming that when it comes to then, okay, we've identified these are the problems, these are the domains, the strengths, weaknesses, and let's say we've identified three big weaknesses that are ultra debilitating. It could be a certain coping tool, it could be a certain lack of relationship, and it could be an attachment style. I would then assume that the actual way that you go and do the fixing of those things is using not then a focal length treatment intervention for each pillar, but you're going to pull in evidence-based research for whatever's the best tool to use in that pillar.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you might use Dr. Dan Brown's attachment disturbances in adult psychology framework to treat that attachment issue, but you've used focal length in order to know that the attachment issue needs work in the first place.
Absolutely.
Okay, got it.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I don't pretend to be the genius in all the things, in all the treatments, because there've been very learned people have worked on this, studying, and there will be. And so, yes, and I'm not going to teach grandma how to suck eggs. It's basically just remember there's an egg there.
Yeah.
How you have learned to do it and you know how to do it is fine.
Yeah.
As long as you're aware that that's there.
Yeah.
And keep that in mind constantly.
And you'll have preferred ways of treating different domains. Like, for example, there's multiple different ways in the trauma domain to go about treating that. It could be EMDR. It could be re-experiencing and reprocessing trauma, blah, blah, blah. So based on your clinical experience, you're going to pull, okay, in the trauma category, what I think works best is this tool. I'm going to use this tool for this patient. Is that right?
Absolutely. And for me to keep in mind that that's limited, that maybe because of my experience, my approach, because of my experience in doing that, my success, and my own bias in that, because it's self-fulfilling bias. But being aware that if that's not working and that domain needs to be strengthened, that I'm still monitoring and this whole soundboard, so to speak, to think, well, hang on, this is having limited effect. Why? What is it in the other soundboards that I'm missing? Why isn't this sticking if it's not? Or is it perhaps that my particular approach is limited or not quite in sync with where this person needs to be, and then I can refer them on? And there will be certainly other things in that domain, the 10 domains of the focal length model, that I don't have the expertise in.
Yes, and you might outsource for that, or you might insource. We definitely need a part two, because what I want to do now that we know the mix board, I'd love to geek out and go through each one and say, what's your top two tools and why that you use for each pillar? Because, like, again, there could be so many tools under each one, and I'd love to know, I have found that this form of attachment healing here and this form of cognitive reprocessing in this one is best, like, as opposed to the trillion others. It'd be really interesting to hear.
I'm happy to do that, Mitch, with some reluctance.
Yeah, tell me.
And the reason is because, again, it's a biased view, and it's only in my limited experience.
Oh, we wouldn't paint it as gospel.
No, absolutely, I get that. But can you see, for someone that's hearing it and say, well, Tony Mastroianni does this, and yes, I have found that this A, B, or C, a way of doing these things, I've found to be useful. But you could get someone else equally experienced or more experienced doing another one, D, E, or F model, that depending on the situation is actually far more potent and more appropriate.
Totally. There's more than one evidence-based tool and there's also multiple evidence-based tools that can work without them being mutually exclusive and collectively exhaustive. I think in the doctor community, maybe there's like almost a little bit of trauma around if you're claiming to be the expert in something, you're just like a sitting duck for someone to come along and shoot you down. That's definitely not the intention of this. That was more just selfishly, I love to hear what are the tools, because it's one thing to say a problem, but then geeking out on the tools and the pros and cons and not even saying like either one works, just doing an analysis of these are some things I've seen when I use this with this and this with this. I think that would be interesting. But nonetheless, this has been incredibly captivating.
Because, thank you. It's been great talking to you. It's really about getting the message out there that it's that awareness of integration of all of those domains, all of those focal lengths. And we need to have the ultimate vision of what we're doing. So you fixing the problem terminology, which everyone uses, is not something I like to use.
No, me either. I was being shorthand.
No, you were. Because I know and what you stand for and what you stand to do all of that. Yeah. Absolutely. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. But it's really, I need to have a vision. And that is, this person needs to be ultimately their potential, what they're born to be.
Mm.
That's my vision.
Yep.
So therefore, it's not about the problems as such. It's not that I'm not aware of problems, but I'm not content, really. Mm. and it's not that I have to do the whole journey either, but as long as I'm integral in being a catalyst for this, for the person that presents to me, to be able to get them give them an awareness that they can reach that potential and who they're born to be and their true purpose.
Amen.
So, if people want to know more, they could go on focallength.com.au.
Plug, focallength.com.au.
And there will have certain events. We're actually starting in February and March again next year events for both the general public as well as professionals and educators. We're actually focusing a bit more on educators next year.
So good. I think it's an incredibly, even though this is fundamental, by the way, for medical professionals, I believe, because what I've heard you basically say is, finally, you're looking at a CEO for someone's mental health. Like, there's so many discrete parts. There's like marketing here and operations here and finance here, which is all these things that's happening, which the GP at the moment is kind of set up to trying to run track across everything, but they're not really. They're kind of like a shift supervisor. And so what you're saying is there is potential for someone to be this, well, technically speaking, the patient's the CEO because they're in charge of their own domain. But again, shorthand, your role is almost looking at the altitude of all the business levers and going, okay, why aren't we profitable?
Absolutely.
And I love that.
Yes. And I want to educate every person.
100%.
That they realize, oh, this is the model. This is how it works. This is how business of me runs.
Yeah. And it's just like how, you know, yes, people can go to business school and do a commerce degree, i.e. a professional would benefit from looking at this model. But I think there are a lot of people listening right now that entrepreneurs and mom and dad shops that build those types of businesses, i.e. I can look after my own mental health, even having this viewpoint in this menu list almost as a way of conceptualizing my healing to build emotional profitability in my own life. And I don't know what your future and vision is for this, but I really see like there's some pretty simple workbooks and flyers and guided resources that or e-learning courses that people could do a lot of their own work
with. Well, having said that, we actually have set up an online resource library,
Sweet.
Which is split up into the domains.
Love it.
And with a lot of resources. I think at the moment we're at 1,500 links to free resources, and it's going to grow. It's just limited by time and resources. So at the moment, trying to do everything myself or with an assistant is difficult. But actually, we are looking into how we can expand that.
Alongside clinical practice as well, I take my hat off to you for still having such energy and motivation and not being chewed up by the system and having the boundaries to make it this far in the marathon and still want to do more. Like, that's its enormously commendable thing.
Well, I can tell you, like any other person, my autopilot would be to fall into, I don't have that.
Yes.
And it's actually part of your own mental health, and what I'm espousing is to actually look at my own and say, hang on, I have to tune into my own purpose.
Yes.
And my own energy of why I was born to be. Otherwise, without that, what am I doing? So really, it's not just pointing the finger at everyone else. It's something, it's a journey all of us have to make.
And I think you have so much good stuff to say. It's almost a shame if you aren't consolidating your legacy into a framework that other people can borrow on. So I'm so glad that you have taken the effort so that we can all learn and grow from the work that you've done and that you continue to do. So thank you so much for coming on. I encourage everyone to jump on and check out the Focal Length Method, and hopefully I'll be able to convince you in for a part two of this someday soon, Tony.
Okay, thank you. And thank you very much for the opportunity.
My pleasure.
I really, really appreciate it. And I really want to wish you well for everything you're doing, because it's a wonderful, wonderful movement.
Thank you.
And an awareness that you're doing. And I want to thank you for that. Thanks, Mitch.
Take care.
Cheers.
Emotions have a natural tendency to dissipate unless they get reinforced. And so if there's more thoughts, more stories, more intentions come along. So the act of how am I and leaving it alone is an act of not adding more stories, adding fuel to it. So it might not go away in 2 minutes, but it then begins to relax and dissipate. And so rather than being the person who has to fix it, we become the person who makes space for the heart, the mind, to relax and settle away itself.